Hey, this is Josh, and we're just going to get right into it with the second part of our conversation with Bill Hader and the movies that made him make Barry. This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
You also brought up a movie that nobody ever talks about, Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah. No one ever talks about Taxi Driver.
Do you want to talk about Taxi Driver?
Yeah. Well, Taxi Driver, I'll just say with Barry, Taxi Driver is the first. I had the double mind blower one night where my dad would wake me up in the middle of the night sometimes and say, hey, you know, you want to watch this movie? You know, it's your dad, your mom won't let me, will get mad at me, but it's one of my favorite movies. And my parents had me incredibly young. They were in their early 20s. My mom was 20 and my dad was 22. So it was, you know, he's in his late 20s being like, come on, let's watch, you know, early 30s. Come on, watch this. And it'd be, you know, Wild Bunch or whatever. And then one of the nights was Taxi Driver. And I just was like, whoa. And then two nights later was Clockwork Orange.
Wait, how old are you now?
What 11. Station was this?
Yeah.
11. But he made me leave during all the rape stuff. No. He was like, you can't watch this. But every time I hear The Thieving Magpie by Mozart, I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, I can't tell you. He goes, no, I cannot tell you.
My dad was taking me to the theaters to see those movies when I was 11. That's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, you'd become a movie nerd or a psychopath or both.
Or, yeah.
But I just went, it was hard to then sit with my friends and watch, you know, The Natural or something and being like, I've seen Clockwork Orange. I can't get excited by this. But Taxi Driver. Yeah. And then I would watch it over and over again. And I've said this a couple of times, I'll abbreviate, but Taxi Driver was the first time I saw something where it unlocked what you could do in movies where, you know, he takes Cybill Shepherd to the porno movie. Mm-hmm. Terrible, that shot where he's on the phone with her and he's saying, hey, did you get my flowers? And you could tell she's turning him down. And the camera dollies off of him while he's still talking. And I was watching it going, this is so uncomfortable, you know, especially at 11, the idea of like a girl being embarrassing herself like that in front of a girl. It's just I think it's the hardest scene to watch in that movie outside of all the violence and everything is watching him take her to the porno movie. It's just terrible.
It's pretty bad.
And you're watching it and like, oh God, I go, I can't watch this. And then that camera dollies off of him and I went, oh, the movie can't watch this. It was like, it's like the filmmaker just went, I don't want to watch this either. I want to see this. Let's just go down here. And I was like, oh, you can do that, you know? And also when he shoots Keitel, the idea of point of view that really, when he walked, you know, suck on this, that famous thing, he shoots Keitel in any other movie, music, he's often, you know, whatever. But he shoots him, oh, and then he just follows him and he sits back down. And now it's just, the point of view is you're someone on the stoop across the street.
Right.
And you just saw a guy shoot another guy. And now it's just you and the shooter. And the shooter sat down and you guys are just sitting there. And it works on some level. Yeah. But no, I really like that movie. But it's a tough one. Like Clockwork Orange now too. Yeah, man. Those are movies when I tell people I like them. They'll try to watch them. I try to watch that one, you know. I can't get into it. I go,
I never get someone of the reaction. I mean, I understand it's difficult, but texture, but I do get people having a very hard time with Clockwork.
Oh,
Orange.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Yeah. No, they just, the Ringer, that site.
It's not a Me Too movie either.
No. It was funny. The Ringer just did an article that was pretty good about the Clockwork Orange on Netflix and like, will people be able to understand that it's a piece of art and that and understand what it's trying to say and not just react to it. And it was interesting. It was an interesting article, but that is definitely one of the movies I like that I say I like that I'm constantly defending why I like it.
You know, actually, remember
Clockwork Orange. Yeah, people go get really angry when they talk to you about that movie. And some of them, most of it, I just go, all right, you know, that's your thing. I'm not going to tell you you're right or wrong. Yeah. I'm going to say, here's how it affected me.
Right.
You know, why I was moved by it, you know, but you know, I get it.
I find my wife's not the the hardcore freak that I am, but will, you know, take a chance on anything. And I'm very fortunate. I found that if I just set it up, I'm never going to show her Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of movies where I just go, you got to understand, it's 1972, and there's a lot of horrible, you know, completely oblivious misogyny in this film.
Oh, yeah.
That's what these idiots were. And she's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then once you sort of set that stage, it's...
But I feel like Clockwork Orange is the misogyny, and it is kind of like born within like how bad the guy is and how bad the society is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that, but that if you take that ability away from somebody, they're not human anymore.
Yeah.
You know? And so that it's this really like we all have this ability to be an Alex. We just choose not to, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no, I don't think the film's misogyny.
But it's so hard to explain that to someone after they watch the first 30 minutes of the movie and they're like, why would I want to watch these guys gang rape a woman? And I go, no, I don't like watching that stuff. But as a story, it's not fun, but not all movies have to be fun. I mean, it's like Virgin Spring, you know, or the other one is Blue Velvet. Blue Velvet's another one. When you guys got to check out Blue Velvet. And I've shown it to friends and they just go, no way, man. Yeah. Isabella Rossellini beaten up walking down the street. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's rough. It's very rough. None of that shit's in Barry.
Well, no, but what's it? I'm sitting here and I want to go back to movies in a minute, but it keeps hitting me because one of the things, I don't know, and we're walking a line here because I don't want to get too explicit in talking about Barry because what anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it to see it. But you go, I remember that you walked this interesting tightrope in the first season because it's a very funny show. It is generally listed when you look at it, it says Barry, comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very fucking funny. But you also go to some really dark places. And for the first half or so of the first season, you were playing an interesting game of teasing that it might go darker in a way that a lot of shows and a lot of movies do. And in a way, a lot of shows and a lot of movies always wimp out. And I remember sitting there for about the first half of the season going, all right, this is really good, but they're going to wimp out. And you go to a place, I'll just say, it's a scene in a car with a friend.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, and it's powerful as shit. It's grueling. And it's the moment when we are now being alerted that this show is going there.
Yeah.
And at which point I just, you know, I stopped being coy and let the show have its way with me. But I mean, it's just because you're going there. But you go to those kind of dark places that some of these movies do, but you do it in a way and you couch it and you surround it with comedy. And, you know, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
But you still manage to go to that darkness that something like Clockwork Orange goes to without ever, I don't want to say sugarcoating, it's not even doing that, but there's nothing.
Yeah.
No one watches Clockwork Orange for entertainment.
Yeah, well, Clockwork Orange somehow weirdly gets away with some of it because it is almost the acting. It almost is like kabuki theater.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing realistic in those performances at all. It's so big.
Yeah.
Like even the warden guy, you know, who's like,
hello, little Alex or something.
Yeah. Patrick. Or yeah,
Patrick McGee.
Who is it? Never the. Most subtle of
actors. Never subdued, yes.
Very great actor.
Do you remember him in Dementia 13?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's in a lot of
Magic Kingdom. Yeah, he's like, food, all right. Try the wine. Yeah,
try the wine.
Yeah, all that stuff. But it's so over the top. I mean, bananas. And yeah, that's what's weird about that movie is like the tone is all over the place. But yeah, with Barry, our thing I feel like is different where it's like, you just want to try to keep it in a real... something real. And like you said, that scene in the car is like you're writing a thing and you get to a scene, you go, well, what would he do? Well, this is what would happen. And everybody goes, okay. And then to HBO's credit, I remember being at the table reading and reading that scene out and my heart sinking, going, they're gonna make us cut this.
Yeah.
No one's laughed. Like there was no laughs after that at the table read, and there was jokes afterwards, and I just thought, well, there goes that, you know. And they went, well, and their notes were about something else. And I was getting antsy, and then I finally just went, what do you think about the scene with Chris? You know?
No, don't point them to it.
Yeah, because I just couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle my stomach was in knots, and I just couldn't handle it. And they went, oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, you guys were great. And I was like, you know, I just kind of came in all mad, and they were like, they get it because they like story. They're the only people giving me notes that say it'd be great if this is a little bit more subtle. I've never gotten a note like that before in my life on TV, yeah. No less. It'd be great if this is a little bit more subtle. But yeah, man, Patrick McGee is great. I like him a lot of stuff.
He's great in Barry Lyndon too.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a little
just an odd presence.
And Mask of the Red Death, he's also great.
Yeah. And Mask of the Red Death is amazing. Yeah. I love that. I'm going to actually talk to. Forget who it is, but I'm doing some other thing. They asked me to talk about because I did Vincent Price on SNL. They want me to talk about the Poe movies.
Uh-huh.
And I think that and Tomb of Ligeia.
Yeah, they're my favorites.
Yeah, Tomb of Ligeia is great. His costume in Tomb of
Ligeia. You know, Richard Chamberlain was supposed to play that part.
What?
Robert Towne wrote it for Richard Chamberlain.
What? I did not know that. Yeah. Are you kidding? How did it become a Vincent Price movie?
It was AIP, and they said, we're making it in England, and we got the money over there, and Vincent works for us, and he's playing it.
Wow.
Because
you know,
the part is actually written for somebody younger.
Yeah, no, that's true. His wife, and yeah.
But it's a really cool movie.
I love that movie.
It's I have to bring up, since we're dancing around Corman, one of the this isn't really going anywhere, but I just want to brag to the audience that I got to see this thing. There was a reading a couple years ago. Joe has an amazing script called Man with Kaleidoscope Eyes, which is about Roger Corman's experience making the trip. You did a stage reading of it at the Vista Theater. And it was a wonderful cast. And the whole thing with the story is that Peter Fonda wanted Corman to direct it. But the condition was Corman had to do acid, which he had never done. And the movie sort of tells that story in the making of the film. And it ends, you get to the point in the film where in a biopic where the legend would scroll by and go, the movie went on to make $1 million, blah, 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 blah. But instead of doing that, they have this lovely little conceit where young Roger has an acid flashback. And Roger Corman today steps out on a tennis court and explains how it went and how the film ended up changing cinematic history by paving the way for Easy Rider. And Bill Hader was young Roger Corman.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most –
Bill
was
Hader
is Roger Corman. It was not. It was an amazing performance
in
and
front
an amazing
of Roger.
Impression.
In
well,
front
I'm, of I'm okay. You fucking directors always rewrite you. But the climax of the thing, Roger himself comes out and watching the dueling Cormans with you and the actual Corman that was such a movie lover's wet dream.
Oh, yeah. That was everyone terrifying. In the room. I went just looking down because I didn't read the email that he was going to I didn't read the email completely.
Well, you didn't know.
So I got there and Joe's like, oh, yeah, you know, Roger's going to love this. And I was like, oh, in my head, I'm like, oh, they're going to send him a tape or something? I'm like, no, he's. And I saw Julie come around. Oh, my God, he's here. And I was like, because I didn't have an impression. I was in the car on my phone watching him give an interview. Oh, gosh, 1980 or something. And I just kind of was watching that in the car. And I was like, okay, I think I can. Okay, let me try this. And but it was a lot of fun. And I mean, I had a blast.
And then getting to
do it,
too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then getting to do it for him,
and then with
was
him.
And then with him, and then sitting there going, I had a Tomb of Ligeia poster up in my room when I was 15, and there is Roger Corman. This is insane, you know, and he was so sweet.
But you really captured him, yeah. Particularly the stillness and the sort of serenity that he manages to go through life with was just so funny because at heart, he's kind of innocent.
Yeah.
And in the movie, he's obviously, you know, doesn't know anything about this drug stuff. And he has to get all of his friends to tell him get Jack Nicholson to get him some drugs and stuff that he doesn't usually do. And it was a wonderful reading. It got us a company.
No,
and
it got
us a sponsor and who was. And we haven't given up. We're still.
Oh, that's great.
We're
man.
Still
no, working I that was a huge, that was huge. I mean, my friend, my best friend, Duffy Boudreau, who writes on Barry and he worked on Documentary Now with me and we grew up together. He came to the reading and just like, after the ride back was like, can you believe that you just did that? Joe Dante and Roger Corman and like all these, you know, and I think Peter Bogdanovich was there.
Yeah, he was there.
Jonathan.
I can't remember who played him.
Jonathan Demme was still alive, and then Julia sent me an email that he had sent and everything. And I just went, this is insane. Yeah, that was so cool. I had a blast, man.
I said to Joe before, I was like, did just now, I was like, did anybody videotape that? He's like, if they had, it would have been on YouTube for years.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Damn it. But yeah. No, that was just fantastic. But I wanted, there were a couple others I wanted to add, because you also mentioned Completely Very Away from Corman, one that I love, and I was just interested in having you draw the connections. You mentioned Kurosawa's Stray Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Which is one of those great, I love his early crime movies.
Yeah.
He did an Ed McBain book, for God's sake, with King's Ransom.
High and Low, yeah.
Oh, High and Low, yeah.
Well, if you've seen season one of Barry, you'll know I'm a massive fan of Kurosawa, because we had a joke in it where the police chief is describing, he's giving a big press conference, and he's describing how these two, his theory of how these two rival, this one guy pitted these two rival people against, rival gangs against each other. And he says, much like the Kurosawa movie, Yojimbo. Because I'll take questions now. And the first reporter says, how do you spell Yojimbo? He goes, well, I think it's just how it sounds. Yo, Y-O, J-J-M, and B-O. Next question. It's like, was that the only film he made? Oh, God, no. He made a lot of movies, and they don't care at all about the crime. Yeah, it's just all these questions about Kurosawa. And you hear it going on in the background of a bar. Alec Berg wrote all that. My favorite line was, they say, where can we get these movies? And he goes, I don't have that information in front of me, but I think you can stream them now. There's various streaming platforms that I'm sure have it, and of course video stores, and just very official. But he knows everything about Kurosawa. But I think I like Stray Dog. It's the economy of the storytelling in it. The first line of that movie is, "I lost my gun."
Yeah,
and then you go, "Oh gosh, now you're in," and just how each scene, you know, there's a thing we kind of beat it to death in the writer's room is each scene needs to be causal. You know, each scene kind of leads to the next scene, and that or something's happened in a scene that now has changed things. So just, it's basically things need to happen. And each scene of that is just, it's this precision in the writing of like, just, but then at the end you get to this kind of showdown, and it is almost like Heat. The movie Heat, before Heat, of the cop and the guy being on this,
chasing
this,
after each other,
being the same person, and then he does this beautiful thing after this fight of this procession of children coming by, and you hear these kids off screen, and this procession of children going by, and you just go, it elevates what could have been just this kind of crime, just a potboiler thing, to this other level of, you know, it made sense how much he liked Russian literature and all that stuff. You know, that's why I always liked it, just the emotion of it, you know, and the kind of big ideas behind it, and just trying to get to this finite truth about two people and having weird empathy for both people, which I was surprised by with the movie. So that was definitely one in watching it that I really loved. Another one, for some reason, I don't know why, and it's not Kurosawa, is Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah.
You know, Sterling Hayden at the end of Asphalt Jungle with the horses and
yeah,
all that, where you kind of go, you see him a little differently and you go, wow, this is, or the way the, help me, great actor he's the kind of pervert guy who gets caught when he makes a little girl, he pops the money with jukebox and Asphalt Jungle. Oh my God.
Lewis Calhoun?
We stumped Joe Dante.
Well, this is not a particularly resonant explanation of who this character was.
Asphalt Jungle.
It's the guy in the jukebox.
The guy it's at the end of the movie. He's one of the conspirators.
Sam Jaffe?
Is that Sam Jaffe? I think you're right. Sam Jaffe. Yes, Sam Jaffe. when they capture Sam Jaffe at the end of that movie, it's not some big shootout or whatever. It's his own moral falling, right. You know, those things I love.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean that comes through, on the show, which it's not the writing show and I shouldn't take advantage of it too much, but by you know, what you just said about the, how every sequence, every scene has to have consequence and lead to the next. I think one of the things I love about Barry is that not only does every scene cause the next one, but I find very often you come towards the end of a scene and you've created a scenario that's so unthinkable. I go like, how the fuck are they going to get out of this?
Yeah.
You take characters to places that they can't easily come back from by the next episode, which is fascinating.
We always try to make it where you sometimes, you know, it's like you start from the ending of a thing and you kind of work backwards and you kind of say, oh, it'd be more interesting if we know we want this to happen. So let's hide it by creating these things that we know isn't going to really matter, but still makes sense, you know? So you think it's going to go there and then you take a big left turn or whatever. But I will say at the end of season two, I mean, Alec and I just had dinner last week and I go, so what do you think happens? And he goes, man, I don't know. We really kind of wrote ourselves into a corner here. So.
Well, did you know at the end of season one? Because I have never felt like a show was done in the best way possible.
Oh, everybody said that. I remember New York Times. Henry Winkler, that made his head explode when Henry read that. Henry just was like, the New York Times said that we shouldn't do another second season. And I was like, well, tough shit. We're doing a second season. I like money. Do you like money? No.
I just feel like that was a much bigger hole. It felt like for as a viewer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, how's he going to get, you know, they're up at this thing. And then what I thought was cool when we went into writing the second season, that was the first thing I said, well, what does everybody think happened to Moss? And Liz Sarnoff, our writer, she's so good at kind of going, why are you start? Because I initially had season, I always start every season by, I kind of go into an office by myself for a month and I write out basically like a big outline, an arc for the season. It's pretty detailed. And then I let the room kind of just demolish it, you know? And it's just this idea of you just want to be wrong fast. You're going to be wrong, but let's just try to be wrong as fast as possible. And so I'll write it all out and then I'll be like, what do you think? And I had it starting in the cabin, you know, with Kusno waking up going, you know, Janice, you know, where are you and everything? And she went, who cares about that? You know, I want to start it off with a big, like, who started off with a group of people we don't know. And I had this idea of Fuchs having another Barry. So she pitched, it should be Fuchs's new Barry going on a thing and it going wrong. And that's how they get his DNA and all that shit. Like, let's just, you know, cut through the crap. And that's where it's good with a writer's room to, you have people telling you where you fuck up a lot, going, why would you do that? Don't you want to do this? And going back to Stray Dog, that's what, Red Kurosawa, they would have, I forget the guy's name, but he would write with five guys. And then he had a one guy was this older writer who wouldn't say anything. He would just kind of sit there and they would all write and they would hand our pages to him and he would read it and kind of go, yeah, you know, whatever. And then he, and I might get this wrong, but he basically said the ending of act one was him losing his gun.
Right.
And this guy said, you should make that the first line of the movie.
Yeah.
Because now shit's happening. Everything was set up to him losing his gun. And let's find, it's the screenwriting 101, but this is in the 40s in Japan. It's like,
yeah,
let's find out about him on the run as opposed to like this boring setup. Right. And it was like, oh, okay. Apparently he's also the guy who said the guy in Akira should just die in the middle of the movie. He was like, just have him die now. And then we'll see how the people.
Jesus.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. I want one of those guys.
Yeah, I want a friend like that. Holy shit.
Just a guy is over in the corner going, like, he should die in the middle of the movie. And then they go, what? They go, yeah, no, it makes sense. You know, again, I read his autobiography and this is how I remember it, but I could be wrong. But this guy apparently was just the screenwriting guru, which I love stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesus. It kind of leads. Do you have time? Can we talk about?
Yeah, no, please. Oh, let's talk. I was a little late. I can talk. I'm good. Right, I'm good.
No, because it made me think of another movie on your list in terms of kind of surprises in terms of the way people you think are the central character are treated. You talked about No Country for Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
Which I just any excuse to talk about No Country for
Old Men. I love that movie. I was knocked out by that movie.
I'm thinking Josh Brolin's exit from the film.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was in the book, too. I read the book. And that idea, too, about, you know, and the way they shot that, too, where they don't do a lot of handheld stuff, but it was handheld, and they just, Tommy Lee Jones, and he just passes him. He's just dead. And I remember, I almost thought, well, that wasn't him. That's not him on the ground. Oh, it's somebody else got killed. Yeah. There's no way that happened. Yeah. And that the idea that, to me, that was the point of the movie, is that we're setting up this thing that you've seen a lot of times as a movie. These guys on the run or whatever, but in reality, here's what happens. This guy gets murdered. Right. Everyone, the wife gets murdered. Everybody fucking dies. And then the end. And you're like, what? Oh, yeah, it's called No Country for... Oh, right, right. It's like your values don't mean shit in this world, you know? And it's like, yeah, the... and I love the end, then I woke up, ticking clock and... Yeah. I will say for Barry, I watched that one with their DP. And another movie I had, I think, on the list was Mother.
Yeah.
Bong Soo-hong. Bong Soo-hong. Yeah. And we would just count setups and go, look, did with four setups that, you know, obviously they could have cut shit out. But look how much they made that work with David Cronenberg, really, is another guy. I watched The Brood a couple of times. Oh, and I was like, look at there. There's like, that's like two setups. You got the whole thing. Or Carol Reed movies, you know. And so you're always, it's always just with that movie, just the simplicity of the directing and the way they shot action in that movie. It was just, you're always kind of from the point of view of the person being attacked. No music again, which I just really like. I just like music coming in at the right time. And I always find in action sequences when there's a lot of music, it's kind of telling you what you're supposed to be feeling, or an emotional moment, it's telling you what you're, but the absence of it kind of, I lean in when that happens. And No Country does it brilliantly, I think. Yeah, I think that movie just really is there. I think that movie just is amazing.
Yeah, no, I love it.
Incredibly,
it's weird because it's not obviously not their original material, and I'm a gigantic fan of them as writers. But do find it's one like that I've probably seen that as many times as I've seen Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, I mean they're phenomenal writers, and I mean A Serious Man is another one of theirs that I thought was really great.
Did you the first time?
I loved it.
Oh, did you? Okay.
A lot of people watch their movies like that, Big Lebowski, whatever. They go, what? You know, I saw Serious Man and I just was like knocked out by it. But yeah, the two people I saw it with were like, what the hell is that?
I thought even the ones I walk out of loving, I like them better the second time than the third time.
I hated
Lebowski.
Yeah.
I can't begin to tell you how much I felt betrayed and ripped off. And finally someone was like, reminded me, like, you do say they have. I was like, not this one. This one's good. And then the second time I saw it, I was like, because I had no idea what I was demanding things of the film that it was not interested in.
Yeah, man. That's why.
Once I knew that.
Just like Blow Up.
Once I knew that, I was in heaven. Yeah.
Wait, what about Blow Up? You didn't like Blow Up?
He didn't like Blow Up.
It's,
really?
It's one of those. I try to be scrupulous about this stuff. I know the difference between I didn't like it and it's bad. And I've always said Blow Up is just one of the, Blow Up is one of those movies that just.
What's your over under movie? What's the movie you think's overrated? Movie you think's underrated?
Oh God.
You could just pick. This is the one around when I get around like film nerd friends. We're in the edit bay. We're waiting for something to come back. I'll just go overrated, underrated, and all the editors. We're all just going to sit because then people get into a massive
fight. I was saying because of doing this show, I finally watched Blow Up again and loved it finally. But
there's a lot of underrated movies.
There's a lot of underrated. We were just talking and I wanted to bring it up. It's a good excuse to as well, but just wondering if, again, I don't know if it's underrated. I genuinely can't argue with anyone who hates this film, but have you seen The Counselor?
Oh, the one with
Cormac McCarthy, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, you know that. What that movie reminded me of was "Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia." For
well,
some
that's
reason,
a good call.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it kind of has like a
yes.
Alfredo, where you're like, this is like a weird fever dream.
Like if Ridley Scott had
did,
made
yeah,
Alfredo Garcia.
That's how I kind of feel about it. It felt like a just off the wall '70s movie.
Yeah,
that. But I saw that in the theater and people, that might be the last movie I saw in the theater where people walked out of it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. People yeah. were not.
But I would
people
give
were
that
like, what
my,
the
my
fuck
under,
is this?
For sure. I think it's an amazing film. I don't know. Over.
Over is kind of
hard. Go down the list of best pictures over the
well,
years.
Well, yeah, but you kind of reminded me. Well, I think this is what you kind of reminded me by bringing up The Brood. Cause I mean, I've had these the privilege of having the conversation with David on this several times, but The Brood is, I think The Brood puts the other divorce movie that came out that year to shame.
Oh, The Ordinary People or Kramer, Kramer versus
I am
Kramer.
Not a Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because I saw them around the same time. And it took David pointing out that they're both divorce movies, only his is honest for me.
Yeah,
go,
right.
Oh, fuck yeah. That's why I'm. So yeah. I'll go The Counselor and Kramer versus Kramer. Joe, what are you, what's your over under?
Well, like I say, I mean, you can really go down the best picture list in the Academy.
Yeah.
And I mean, most of the movies that people remember today and really think of as classics are movies that seldom got close to the Academy. And the ones that did have tended to date to a point that, you know, I mean, how many people sit through Dances with Wolves anymore?
Yeah. And always go like, and that beat Goodfellas or Best Picture and Best Director.
I mean,
well, my favorite was the year that, what was it? It was
the year that Rocky won.
Right.
76.
Well, no. The one I always think of is the year that Ron and Brazil and Preetzi's Honor. You had these, you know, Preetzi's, we're all up for Best Picture, and it was, yeah, Out of Africa.
One, yeah.
Which I think I've seen part of on TV, so I guess I can't. Does anybody, how many people, what are the odds of driving by a Repertory Cinema anywhere in America right now and they're showing Out of Africa?
I don't know. I've never seen it.
They'll run it at the New Beverly if they can get it in 35.
Yeah. I've never seen it. I've never seen that movie. Yeah.
It's an illustrated John Barry score.
Oh, yeah.
I like John Barry, but.
Oh, I knew what
I like Sidney Pollack's movies, though. I liked, Three Days of Condor.
Three Days of Condor's good.
I'll tell you an underrated Sidney Pollack movie is Castle Keep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's really good.
Do you like They Shoot Horses? Don't they?
I do.
Yeah, They Shoot Horses. Do.
Just watched it.
Not a fan.
I kind of had a visceral, and I realize I have this every time I see it.
You don't
it,
like Gig Young movies.
You what?
You don't like Gig Young movies.
I love Gig Young movies. Alfredo Garcia. I viscerally hated it. And I watched it back to back with Day of the Locust, which
viscerally
I
really
loved, which are both incredibly depressing movies with animals in the title.
What's to viscerally hate?
That's true. Can you hate something without it being visceral? I don't know.
You don't like Red Button movies.
He's
there goes Poseidon Adventure.
He's amazing. I don't know. There's just something about it it feels.
Are you talking about the filmmaker or are you talking about the concept?
Yeah, no, it feels patronizing somehow. It feels, I feel like I can see the rich people pretending to empathize
with
the poor folk in it somehow.
And, I guess I would, you know, I read what's the guy, Horace McCoy wrote the book. I remember reading the story in some anthology of like great, you know, crime novels, and so I think I always thought of it as like a crime story for some reason, but yeah, I can see that. What's underrated for you?
Almost everything.
Yeah. Do you have any movie that you love that people just constantly are like, what, how the hell did you like that?
Well, I guess when you get into the Spider Baby kind of movies, you know, then people
those make sense. Like, I love Vampire
Circus.
I'll
tell you, underrated movie is The President's Analyst.
Oh, yeah.
No one underrates President's Analyst.
Well, it was pretty underrated when it came out.
Okay, yeah.
Well, that's the crux of your question. Is when you say underrated, what does that mean?
Yes.
Underrated at the time or underrated now?
But that's one of those movies, by the way. That and Spider Baby, I've shown to people countless times I've never had anybody not just love both of those.
Yeah. I've shown people Vampire Circus, and they've been like,
Vampire Circus is pretty
good. What the hell is this? And I'm like, I love Vampire Circus.
I don't know Vampire
Circus. It's very offbeat.
Vampire Circus, going back to Clockwork Orange, the wife, Patrick McGee's wife, is in Vampire Circus.
Adrienne Corey.
Adrienne Corey.
And what is
it? Who just passed away, I think.
It's about Count Mitterhouse, who is the resident vampire in this Balkan village.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's the circus that comes to town.
And David Prowse is in it.
It's very Charles Finney kind of. It's the circus that comes to town, but it's a circus that's they have a lot of strange acts and, because some of them are vampires and
would be strange.
And basically their lot in life is to take all the kids from the village and to turn them into vampires and eat them.
Vaguely, what year?
73.
Oh, right. Okay, so it's later.
I feel like it's got to be the same casting director as Clockwork Orange because David Prowse is in it.
Yeah.
And she's in it. Like, there's a lot of people from. They have a
story. I can't remember when it was when I first realized that happened.
Yeah.
Like watching some little trivial film and realizing it's 90% of the cast of, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah. You see people all the time in those movies.
Yeah. No, Vampire Circus is worth a look.
I can find it.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have it on 16 that I can.
I did have it on 16, but it's so gettable on video.
I always say a movie I always like comedy wise, but it's so hard to talk about, I guess, Woody Allen nowadays without people getting like mad or whatever. But, it's so hard for me. It's like Polanski, Woody Allen. Like, I totally get it. I understand. But I already saw the movie.
Too bad they're great filmmakers.
I already saw the movie, you know? It's like, I already saw the thing. So it's like hard for me to disassociate. But Love and Death, the Woody Allen movie, that movie really makes me laugh. That's a movie John Mulaney and I talk about a lot. And it really makes us laugh. And there's I used to do a guy in Saturday Night Live called Stefan, who was like the Weekend Update guy. And there was a joke in it where John would write things in the cue cards to make me laugh. And one of the things was, I would say to Seth Meyers, I go, "Hey, Seth," I'm reading this for the first time. And I says, "Hey, Seth, do you know how they have Blackula, the Black Dracula?" And he goes, "Yes." I go, "Well, they have a Jewish one." And he goes, "What's his name?" And he goes, "Sidney Applebaum." And Sidney Applebaum is a name that's in Love and Death. It was so directly to make me laugh, where the guy goes, he's the guy who's like the chancellor or whatever to Napoleon. He goes, "History will mock my name." Sidney Applebaum. And he's like, "That's just what they're expecting." Like, he had the two Napoleons. The two Napoleons are fighting each other in the background. But I absolutely love that movie. And then I think the overrated movie, and this is a very specific reason for me, is I was never a big fan of Fight Club. And I think the reason was is because I had friends and movie fans, friends who wanted to start Fight Clubs.
Oh, Jesus.
And I have friends who I would buy a DVD and they would go, "You don't own that DVD. That DVD owns you," and all this shit. And I would go, "Oh, fuck off, man. It's a movie. Will you fuck?" It became like their ethos or whatever. So that is a very specific thing. I have not watched the movie since. So many people love it. But I just have a very personal, visceral thing. I like David Fincher's, you know, Seven. I think Zodiac's a fucking masterpiece. I think that movie's great. But that movie, for some reason, I can't go back. I can't try to watch it without, do you know, I don't know if you had that thing where it's like either you have like a very personal thing that the movie might be great, but I just went, "Oh God, if I have to," remember my dad saying you can never listen to Blackbird by the Beatles because having to sit and watch so many people try to play that on guitar at parties and just was like, I can't handle anytime that song. He's like, "I turn that off." He's like, "I can't handle that song." Because
that's, by the way, I have a thing like, and I can't imagine your show ever using it, but if you ever do play Hallelujah on Barry, I'm fucking out.
That's the one
for me. I can't do it. Even the Leonard Cohen original, I start getting.
Yeah.
But no, I knew a guy who lived in a basement of a house on Wilton in Hollywood, and it was a dirt walls or somehow. A very odd guy, looked a bit like a troll. And he was a friend of ours. He was the landlord of it's a long story. Strange, disturbing guy, and passionately obsessed with a movie. And it was literally the only film he owned. This is what bothered me. I think it's fine if you own this movie, but if the only movie you own when you live in a dirt basement is Natural Born Killers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It is alarming.
That's alarming. I think we have a problem here, guys. I think we have a problem here, everybody.
I wanted just a small thing. I realized I was trying to think, what was the film I wanted to mention when you brought up The Brood? And I was thinking Oliver Reed
Oliver Reed is one of
Stray.
My,
oh God,
yeah, Oliver
Stray.
Reed and The Brood is one of the greatest performances.
He's amazing in that film. But you've probably seen this film, but if you haven't, because one of the things I like about Stray Dog is you watch it and then you realize that one of the interesting things about this film is having a gun in Japan is a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a much bigger deal in the film than it would be in an American film. And it just taps into, there's a wonderful Oliver Reed film from I think late 60s called Sitting Target.
Oh, mm-hmm. No, I've never seen that.
It's essentially, I've also said it's the best of, it's like a Richard Stark Parker novel, except it's not.
Oh,
the
cool.
Best one ever made. And it's Oliver Reed, and he's gotten out of prison, and he's looking for revenge, and Ian McShane's in it.
Oh, my God.
But the kind of the gag is, he's got a gun.
Yeah.
Running around 60s London. And it's like, oh my God, a gun. And the entire film hinges on the fact that having a gun is completely insane.
Boy, how you get that gun?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a phenomenal.
Oh, you know what other movie I like, which is a horror movie that a lot of people, well, people like it. Edgar Wright loves his Deathline. Deathline's great. That's another one that I feel like I watch it and I go, this is a really good movie. Yeah. It's like super, that's an incredibly well-made
that's
movie.
That's underrated.
Very underrated. Yes. Beautifully, it's like a very beautifully made movie, I think, is Deathline. I like that one. Wait, and you said Oliver Reed, maybe, and you said Richard. Oh, do you like The Outfit?
Oh, God,
Robert Duvall?
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
Yeah, I love
it. Yeah, that was another one. The Outfit, those John Irving movies, my dad, those would be on late night television. Like that and Rolling Thunder.
Rolling Thunder okay, Joe, come on. You both of you guys, I've got two great directors here. Is he a good director or does he just have a good eye for material? Because I find I never walk, like I must have seen Rolling Thunder 50 times, and there's never a moment in it where I find myself marveling at anything, except I'm just absorbed into the story, which of course is the goal. I mean, you see somebody you look at and go,
he's a very solid director. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind
solid
of
yeah. Is a good.
You know what? He could have
tell people who we're talking about.
What?
John
Irving.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, John. Yes.
John Irving was, but also like the scene in there could have been some really gratuitous scenes in that movie, like with the hand and the garbage disposal and all that, and you could have seen it or the end shootout and the stuff. But I when I watch those movies, I always feel like he's really interested in the characters, and then I think the end shootout to me also Tommy Lee Jones is really good in that. I'll go get my gear is like one of the most badass, like every person in the theater starts cheering.
Yep.
I found the man who killed my wife and son. Pause. I'll go get my gear. And it was like, everybody just goes nuts. And you're like, oh Jesus. But it's all done. And like right before that scene is that scene with them. They're just sitting around having dinner and you can just tell he just hates.
Yeah.
It's about vets and he can't stand, being home and he just wants to be doing this some more and all that. And I also feel like the end fight scene, though, the gunfight scene also, I don't know if you could tell it, where you could tell, I feel like, and I could be 100% wrong, they didn't have a lot of time. You know those scenes where you go, oh man, they're really leaning on this piece of coverage in the edit where it's like there's a hallway shot and you're like, oh man, they're just trying to like, that's the spine of the whole thing. And they're just going like, when I watch that end scene, I really love it. I think it's great. But you could tell just the budget constraints or time or whatever. I now know, having done this, I'm like, oh man, they're really leaning on that.
You find you watch movies differently now that you actually.
Oh my gosh, 100%. Where you go, oh, they only have one, they only had that one shot.
Yeah.
Or they only had this, or they slowed that down because they possibly didn't get a.
Now, does that make you more analytical when you want? Or can you still just sort of sit back and enjoy something without having to feel that you have to analyze
it? It's both, you know? Like, I'll watch something like Cranes Are Flying, like that Russian movie. And I go, I don't know how they got these shots in 1957. This is unreal. Now that I know, or like a Max Ophuls movie. Yeah. And I go, I don't know how they did this in this at that time. These cameras are massive. How did they get those shots? You know? So I have that because of the knowledge. But then the flip side too, where you just go like, come on guys, that's like, or, oh man, they must've been in trouble. You know, it's like this thing's not working and you'll see where they flip shots around to
blow them up,
yeah. Now you can just spot those now, especially now with digital, you can blow things up and it doesn't.
Sam Fuller didn't have that, unfortunately.
No, Sam Fuller did not have that.
So many blow-ups.
Yeah, Sam Fuller.
Sam didn't get enough coverage.
No, that's what. The first time I noticed blow-ups were in Mel Brooks movies. We were watching Young Frankenstein as a kid, and he would have...
Yeah, but...
Or optical zooms into things where it'd be Gene Wilder's eyes, and then it would kind of... I go, why is that
so grainy?
Grainy, and it's too smooth. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not an operator behind it or something.
Well, part of it is as a kid growing up.
That's what kids do.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, redundant statement. As a child, I would watch movies on TV where they're all panning and scanning and early. Figured that out. So I wouldn't even know watching movies if was this something in the original film or in my mind, at a certain age, if you saw one of those artificial blow-ups, It was because there were boobs in the scene and they were hiding.
That must
have been what's going on. So every time I see one of those, I think of boobs.
You watch those like Blake Edwards movies that were shot like the comedies are, you know, you're shooting really widescreen, like 10 or in the Pink Panther movies. Or there's one, What'd You Do in the War, Daddy? Is one movie. And there's a shot in that, I remember, where these two cars ram into each other. And I would tell Alec, there's a shot in Ronnie Lilly where I'm like, this is the Blake Edwards shot where he's running at him to kick me in the supermarket, but he misses. Mm-hmm. It's just the pan reveals the thing. Blake Edwards would do that shit all the time. But in that pan and scan format, it was two shots.
Right.
And it never...
Doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And then I saw it widescreen and I went, wow, he's a good director. I didn't realize how good of a director he was until I saw the stuff at the aspect ratio that it needed to be at. Before that,
That's another thing in which we're lucky now in our era, that you can actually see these pictures that have been, you know, panned and scanned for, you know, 25, 35 years.
Oh, yeah.
Now you can see them the way they really look.
I know. I watched, because I had two sisters, I watched Grease a lot growing up because my sisters always wanted to watch Grease. I have daughters and they want to watch Grease. And I will say, seen it widescreen. I had seen it so many times, pan and scan, seen it widescreen. I was like, oh, there's like these are really well choreographed dance numbers. There's like all these, like he really filled the frame and there's like great stuff going on here, especially at the end. But I didn't see any of that with the other version of it. Yeah, no, I forget what the question was.
We've been talking too long.
He's losing it.
No, I'm not losing it.
I remember seeing something where it was just two characters talking with a tree in the distance and seeing it on TV, and all you saw was the tree.
Two noses.
Yeah.
At an early age, figuring out they're not showing me.
Wait, what was Piranha shot in?
Regular.
That was shot regular. I remember watching Piranha. My grandparents had a lake house outside Grand Lake. And the video store, which was in a Reser's, was in a grocery store, and they had videos in the back. And they would always have the new releases or whatever. But I would merely go over to the horror section, and I wore out their Piranha because we were swimming. And it was a great movie to watch. And Paul Bartel getting... I'd never wanted to get in inner tubes. I'm being honest, because I saw Piranha and I just, when he gets it, I was just, you know, that movie's great. I love that movie. I also like the stop motion stuff in that movie.
Yes, I
know. Yeah.
Even
hopefully that's the big takeaway from this episode. People go see Piranha.
Yes,
I love
for the
Piranha.
Stop motion.
Oh no,
Phil Tippett. Did he do the Phil Tippett? Yeah. And you have Brad Boutin on that movie.
Phil Tippett is the guy who gets the diver who gets eaten by the piranhas, and then and then the water skier skis past him, and it's Phil sitting there, you know, in the water with his face sticking up and gore all over him.
I love that movie.
And on that note,
by the way, you know, there's a new Steelbook Blu-ray.
There is a new Steelbook 4K Blu-ray, which I think just came out. As we say in the
business. Dropped.
Yes.
A new steel K. Yeah, steel.
I wish I had it on VHS.
I could.
I'm sure. Yeah,
I can give you one.
I wish I had someone to watch it. So cool, man.
Keep them in the bathroom.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
It's the Raina Backus packaging. There's some company I just saw has got a couple of films
The new gimmick is to package DVDs in packages that look like VHS.
My Mandy Blu-ray came in.
We never do an episode where he doesn't mention Mandy.
I've seen Mandy.
Are you?
I saw Mandy. I thought it was cool.
Oh, okay.
I really liked it.
Only the best picture ever.
Are you on? No. I think it was last year. One of last year's best.
I really liked it. I thought I was like, I have no idea what I'm watching right now, but I thought it looked amazing.
Yeah,
and it was really cool. I had an editor who liked it, except he didn't like the fight sequences, and that was this weird thing where he's like, the movie's so beautiful, and the fight sequences goes into like this kind of traditional multicam coverage. Like he had this thing, but right. So I haven't gone back and watched it again since he. But what the fuck does he know? I'm going to name him out so Mandy fans can go kill him. No.
Bill, it seems like we finally got to Mandy, which is really, and we plug Piranha.
Yep.
That's kind of it. Piranha. Is basically we do the show and it's like, can we plug Piranha? Can we talk about Mandy?
And I made the whole list be about my show. So we all come out great.
We all came out good.
We got what we wanted.
We all got what we wanted out of this fucking thing.
But I'm serious. I mean, you guys know who Bill is and et cetera, all the rest. But please, if you are among our listeners and you haven't seen Barry, you have the internet and there's two whole seasons of this thing waiting for you.
It's a binge watch.
Yeah. I hate pushing TV shows on our movie show, but my God,
it means a lot.
TV show made by film lovers. And I think it's the best thing on right now. So
thanks, man.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks. Thank you, man.
You'll have to come back when the third season comes out.
Yeah. And it'd be like how we wrote ourselves out of a hole.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.